So Hosea chapter 1, Hosea has predicted the destruction of Israel and the restoration, or the deliverance rather, of Judah. Just on a little time scale, the family of Abraham through Israel stays united through the kingdom, United Kingdom under Saul, David, Solomon. Brings us down to the 900s. I forget exactly where, about 920. And then there's the division, and you get Israel and Judah. Goes on for a little while till the year 721 BC and ends with the Assyrian conquest, 721 under Sennacherib. Judah goes on to 586. Because they were more faithful, and it wasn't until 586 that Jerusalem fell to Nebuchadnezzar, and they carried away slaves in Babylon, 70 years, and then they're restored, and the line continues right down to AD 70 with the destruction of the temple by the Roman armies. 40 years or so after the death of Christ. And that all came true the way he said. But verse 10 of Hosea chapter 1, yet the Israelites will be like the sand on the seashore, which cannot be measured or counted. In the place where it was said to them, you are not my people, they will be called the sons of the living God. The people of Judah and the people of Israel will be reunited, and they will appoint one leader and will come up out of the land, for great will be the day of Jezreel. This is a great promise of restoration. It's not yet happened. The people of Israel have still not been restored. Nobody knows really where they are. There are some theories about them. One is that some of them actually have drifted into Judah, and certainly some of them did go over to Judah. They repented, and they joined up with Judah and abandoned Israel. But that doesn't seem to fulfill the terms of this prophecy. Other people, like Roger Forster, whom I think you know, Roger believes that the church is the Israel of God. I would have some difficulties with that view, frankly, although he is pretty convinced about it, and he's no mean student, and he does base his ideas on the scriptures, of course. But to me, it must be a restoration of the literal Israel with the literal Judah. Several of the terms, for instance, verse 11, the people of Judah and the people of Israel will be reunited. Not they'll just be joined up for the first time. So the church wouldn't suit that particular expression, reunited. The church never was united to Judah. So it can't be reunited. And it's been the place where it was said to them, they will be, you're not my people, they will be called the sons of the living God. So there's going to be a restoration. And you would expect that from the word Jezreel, which means God sows or God plants. Because when you plant something, then you get a harvest. Now, although it seems like the end of the line, although it seems like total disaster, and the nation of Israel are buried and they disappear, when God buries something, it grows again. And so there's going to be a harvest out of this, and out of utter despair and defeat and hopelessness, there will come restoration. And Judah and Israel reunited, and they will appoint one leader, and of course that will be Christ, when he returns and they recognize him. And the end of verse 11, they will come up out of the land. They will grow up out of the soil, literally. For great will be the day of Jezreel. And God is always able to do that. And he tells us that not to encourage us to fail, but because if we do fail, there is always the possibility of restoration. There's never a need for suicide or anything like that. However hopeless the situation may appear, God can always put it right. A little promise to that effect, Joel 2:24, I will restore unto you the years that the locusts have eaten. Joel 2:24, I'll give you back the years the locusts have eaten. But this idea is picked up by Paul, and it is applied to ourselves as the Gentiles. We were not his people, now we are. And we'll have a look at that. It's Romans chapter 9. The specific reference is verse 24. Well, to pick up the sentence, begin with verse 22. What if God, choosing to show his wrath and make his power known, bore with great patience the objects of his wrath, prepared for destruction? What if he did this to make the riches of his glory known to the objects of his mercy, whom he prepared in advance for glory? Even us, whom he also called, not only from the Jews, but also from the Gentiles. As he says in Hosea, I will call them my people who were not my people, and I will call her my loved one who is not my loved one. And it will happen in that very place where it was said to them, you're not my people, they will be called the sons of the living God. That's a direct quotation, of course, from Hosea chapter 1, and he is applying it here to the Gentiles, and it has a reasonable application, although it's not its primary one. So, it's quite true. There was a time when we were not his people. And there was a time, like that, but the privilege is ours now of being called the sons of the living God. And part of the idea behind that is the Roman ceremony of adoption. A Roman nobleman might have several sons, probably did, and they would just be in the care of slaves. The father wouldn't have much to do with them. He'd just get reports about them. He wouldn't take any interest in them, and he would provide in terms of money to see they were looked after, but he wouldn't take any hand in their discipline or anything like that. But he'd learn all about them. And then the day would come when he would decide on one, and he would give a big party, and he would invite all the other noblemen that he knew. They would all come, and having decided on that one son would stand forward in the middle of the banquet, and the father would come, and he would place his hand on his shoulder, and he would say, this is my son. And he was his son already by birth, but this was adoption. Not in the way we understand adoption, the way they understood adoption. And from that time on, that boy would then be regarded as the only son of his father. And he would inherit the whole wealth and property of his father. From that moment on, he could negotiate with equal authority from the father. He would have a ring with the family seal on it, and his signature would carry the same weight as his father's signature, etc. And Ephesians 1 tells us we're predestined to the adoptions of sons, to the glory of his Father, something that will happen in heaven when God acknowledges us before the angels as being his family, his sons. Tremendous privilege when you remember that we did not belong, we were strangers to all the promises of God and to all the covenants, etc. So that is still to come, but the primary meaning of this prophecy is the reunification of Israel and Judah, and I want us to see that in the context of this section in Romans, the whole context, chapters 9 to 11. See, a very rapid outline of Romans. Chapters 1 to 3 deal with the fact of sin, ending up with a statement in 3:23, all have sinned and come short of the glory of God. And he spent three chapters developing that argument, and he makes the point very forcefully, both the Jew with the law and the Gentile without the law, we all come short of the glory of God. And so there is the fact of sin. And then, chapters 4 to 8 all deal with the mercies of God, or the blessings of God. Chapter 4 and 5, they deal with justification, or being given a righteousness that is not ours, a credited righteousness that Jesus Christ obtained, and he gives to us by grace through faith. And then 6 and 7 deal with deliverance from the power of sin. The old man is crucified, buried with Christ in baptism. We're raised just as he was raised to a new life, so we've been raised to live a new life, etc. Chapter 7, O wretched man that I am, who shall deliver me from the body of this death, etc. Then chapter 8 deals with walking in the Spirit, praying in the Spirit, and eternal security. And we see this, the whole plan of God's blessings for us, then in 4 through 8, his blessings or his mercy. And the logical next step to that is Romans 12:1. Let's just pick up at the end of Romans 8 there, and see how he concludes this, verse 31 of Romans 8. What then shall we say in response to this? If God is for us, who can be against us? He who did not spare his own son, but gave him up for us all, how he will not also along with him graciously give us all things? Who will bring any charge against those whom God has chosen? It is God who justifies. Who is he that condemns? Christ Jesus, who died, more than that, who was raised to life, is at the right hand of God and is also interceding for us. Who shall separate us from the love of Christ? Shall trouble or hardship or persecution or famine or nakedness or danger or sword? As it is written, for your sake we face death all day long. We are considered as sheep to be slaughtered. No, in all these things we are more than conquerors through him who loved us. For I am convinced that neither death, nor life, nor angels, nor demons, neither the present, nor the future, nor any powers, nor height, nor depth, nor anything else in all creation will be able to separate us from the love of God that is in Christ Jesus our Lord. And you just couldn't dream up a more emphatic statement of our security in Jesus Christ. And that is the sort of ultimate in the list of blessings. Not only do we have all these things, a righteousness credited to us by Christ through faith that we don't have to earn, deliverance from the power of sin, guidance by the Spirit, prayer in the Spirit, but all the things that we have for keeps. Nothing can separate us from the love of God, he says. I beseech you therefore, says 12:1, that you present your body a living sacrifice.
And he's moving on into terms of practical behavior. If we've got all these mercies, if we've got all these blessings, then the logical, intelligent, reasonable behavior is 12 to 16. So you say, well, if 12.1 follows from the end of chapter 8, what are these chapters 9, 10, 11 doing in there? Are they just padding? You know, was Paul trying to get a few extra credits by making his dissertation a bit longer? Not really. Somebody might just come up with this question. Excuse me, Paul, you know, I don't want to be awkward. I don't want to be argumentative, but you just said nothing can separate us from the love of God in Christ. Now, I've got a question, you see, because didn't God once choose the Jews? And didn't he once choose Israel? Now, if he chose the Jews, Judah, and he chose Israel, where are they today? They're not the people of God now, are they? Their temple just got smashed up. So how can you possibly say that I am secure in Christ if they were not secure? Because if God changed his mind about the Jews, he can change his mind about me. And so 9, 10, and 11 are in anticipation of that question. And what Paul is saying is this. Hey, listen, if you think that God has changed his mind about the Jews, you're wrong. Chapter 11, verse 25. And this is at the end of a long argument. We're not going to take the time to go right through the argument. But 11:25 says this. I do not want you to be ignorant of this mystery, brothers, so that you may not be conceited. Israel has experienced a hardening in part until the full number of the Gentiles has come in. And so all Israel will be saved, as it is written, the deliverer will come from Zion, that's Jerusalem, he will turn godlessness away from Jacob, that's Israel. And this is my covenant with them when I take away their sins. As far as the gospel is concerned, they are enemies on your account, but as far as election is concerned, they are loved on account of the patriarchs. For God's gifts and his call are irrevocable. He will never take them back, and he has not changed his mind about Israel and Judah. So verse 30, just as you who were at one time disobedient to God have now received mercy as a result of their disobedience, so they too have now become disobedient in order that they too may now receive mercy as a result of God's mercy on you. For God has bound all men over to disobedience so that he might have mercy on them all. And then he finishes with a great outburst of praise to the wonderful workings of God. So the argument is this. Israel and Judah are not a threat to your security in Christ. They're not a suggestion that God forgets his promises or changes his mind or is even conditioned by our disobedience. The greatest evidence you could ever have for eternal security is the security of Judah and Israel. Even though Israel were absolutely hopeless, so rotten that there was no knowledge of God, no truth, no justice, no faithfulness in the land, even though he had to plow up the land and bury them, even though for 2,600 years they've not been around, they are still his chosen people and he's going to restore them. And Judah, although for 2,000 years they have disappeared from the scene, he's going to restore them too. In the Second World War, 6 million Jews were executed by Hitler. In the 1920s, more than that were executed in the Russian purges. Nobody knows how many Jews died
in the 1920s at the hands of Stalin. In spite of all that, there's still a Jewish nation. In the year 1945, when the statistics of what had happened in the Hitler gas chambers became public knowledge, Sir Winston Churchill said, there will never again be a Jewish nation. 3 years later, independence was declared in Jerusalem, 1948, March 25th. You probably consider yourselves mostly to be Americans or Canadians. Right? Look back two generations, you're probably European, or maybe four generations. Maybe there's even somebody at genuine Ivy League, you know, and you can go back, wow, perhaps, maybe even 300 years. But you don't regard yourself as a European. You regard yourself as an American or as a Canadian. The Jews have been out of their country 2,000 years, but Israel is still their homeland. And the survival of that nation is a most amazing mystery. Only God could have done it. And they're reassembled, and the promises are all coming true. So, however grim the situation looks, and however hopeless, God can always restore it. He can do it for Israel, he can do it for you. He didn't go back on his promise to them, he's not going to go back on his promise to you. Okay, let's move on to chapter 2. And chapter 2 is a chapter which deals with discipline, first of all, and then with restoration. The balance of it is rather beautiful. Discipline comes first, and God outlines a number of steps that he is going to take in discipline. And he says, I will, I will, I will. What I've done in my Bible, I've just put a little triangle around the letter I, where it has to do with what he's going to do in judgment. And then when he moves over to his steps of restoration, I put a little circle around the eye, just so that they stand out and I can pick them out. You may or may not wish to do the same. But starting in verse 6, therefore I will block her path with thorn bushes. Same verse, I will wall her in so she cannot find her way. Verse 9, I will take away my grain. Halfway down that verse, I will take back my wool and my linen. Verse 10, I will expose her lewdness. Verse 11, I will stop all her celebrations. Verse 12, I will ruin her vines. Halfway down that verse, I will make them a thicket. Verse 13, I will punish her for the day she burned incense to the Baals. Then 14 begins the section on restoration. 14, I am now going to allure her. Same verse, I will lead her into the desert. 15, I will give her back her vineyards. 17, I will remove the names of the Baals from her lips. 18, I will make a covenant for them. Next, the last line, I will abolish from the land the bow, the sword, and the battle, etc. 19, I will betroth you to me forever. Next line, I will betroth you in righteousness and justice, in love and compassion. 20, I will betroth you in faithfulness. 21, I will respond, declares the Lord, same as I will respond to the skies. 23, I will plant her for myself in the land. Next line, I will show my love to the one called not my loved one. Next line. I will say to those called not my people, you are my people. So these are going to be God's dealings with them. We'll just have a brief look at some of the ideas contained here. Verse 6. I will block her path with thorn bushes. I will wall her in so that she cannot find her way. She will chase after her lovers but not catch them. She will look for them but not find them. And this is going to be the frustration of Israel. If you could retain the parallel of Hosea dealing with Gomer, he's going to be out planting thorn bushes all over the garden so that when she sneaks out at night, she'll run into thorn bushes and she won't be able to find a way out of the garden, and she'll miss all her assignations, and her clientele will get tired waiting for her and go away, and she'll just be frustrated. And God does sometimes deal with us in those ways. There was a guy came to Cape Maria about 10 years ago called Marco. He was from Costa Rica. He had a brother who was a very brilliant soccer player. And his brother was in Costa Rica. He was not a Christian, but Marco had often talked to him about Christ. And just before Marco had left home to come over to England, he had a good long talk with his brother. He'd again explained the gospel to him and said, now, you know, you really need to give your life to Christ. And his brother said, look, Mark, I can't think about that now. You know, there's an international game coming up soon, and I have a possibility of being chosen to represent Costa Rica in this big international game. And I've just got my heart set on playing for my country. So leave it for now, and if I get a place in the team, then I'll consider what you've said and I'll think about becoming Christian. About a month later, Marco got a letter to say that his brother had been chosen to play for Costa Rica, and he's very excited about it, of course. Marco called him from England and he said, do you remember what you said? That if you were chosen to play for your country, you'd become a Christian. His brother said, look, I've not got time for that now. I've got what I want. Forget it. And Marco came and he said, I don't know whether I've done the right thing, but I've just prayed to God that if this is a real hindrance to my brother becoming a Christian, he'll take it away. His brother never did play for Costa Rica. The week before he was due to play, he had a road accident, multiple fractures of the femur, thigh bone. He'll never play soccer again. A couple of months later, he did give his heart to Christ. God doesn't enjoy doing those kind of things to us. He really doesn't. But if he knows it's for our ultimate good, sometimes he'll just hedge up the way and block it. And we won't find the thing that we're longing to find. Also, he's built into our nature a kind of law of diminishing returns. It works with drugs. You never get the same great high that you get the first time you take that drug. You have to take stronger and stronger doses to try to get the same experience. And whatever else, you make an idol like that, whether it's sex or whatever it is, you know, it becomes more and more difficult to attain the same kind of experience. And God has built these little checks and balances into our makeup. And if something does get right out of proportion like that, then we find that our way is hedged up. And sometimes he'll go to fairly extreme lengths to bring us back to himself. Why? Well, look at her attitude. Verse 5. their mother has been unfaithful and has conceived them in disgrace, she said, I will go after my lovers, who give me my food and my water, my wool and my linen, my oil and my drink. Israel attributed all things to the Baals. You know, it's the Baals who give me my food and water. It's the Baals that give me my wool and my linen. It's the Baals that give me the olives and the wine. Verse 8, she has not acknowledged that I was the one who gave her the grain, the new wine and the oil, who lavished on her the silver and gold, which they used for Baal.
Now try to imagine this, if you would, in the context again of Gomer and Hosea. As Hosea's provided for her a home, as he's bought her clothes, as he's fed her, as he's bought her jewelry and perfumes. And one day, he sees her getting all dressed up to go out. And boy, she's dressed to kill, or something. And she's got all the finery on there. And he says, you look nice today. Where are you going? She says, out. She said, I'm really glad I bought you that dress. Boy, it was expensive, but it really looks good on you. You? You didn't buy it? What did you think you bought it? Charlie gave me this. No, I didn't. I bought it for you. Still got the bill. Look, Charlie gave me this. Well, why are you wearing it? Going out with Fred. Well, how about that nice gold necklace? You know? I really enjoyed buying that for you. I knew it looked good on you. And it was an expression of my love to you. You gave me this? What are you talking about? Brian gave me this. And if you want to know, I'm wearing it for Fred. It'd be pretty hard to take, wouldn't it? Yeah. And yet, God had given all these things to Israel as an expression of his love, gold and silver, food, wine, everything. And she had just taken those things, said thank you to the Baals for them, never even acknowledged that God gave them to her, and used them to commit further spiritual adultery by making them offerings to other idols. Now, is this something very remote, or is it something that we do? Where do you get your money from? Your dad? Because you worked hard in the summer and you saved. Where'd you get it from? Because you were really smart and before you were born you decided to be born into a fairly affluent family in a country where you could earn a lot of money. Is that right? What part did you have to play in your being born into the family in the country where you were born? And if you have a slightly superior brain and a slightly superior education, is that something that you've done? Is it? And if you happen to be reasonably good looking and people are attracted to you because you look nice, did you decide which way you're going to look? Did you make yourself that way? And if you've got some special talents like music or something like that, where'd you get those from? Wouldn't it be fair to say that absolutely everything that you've got, including every mouthful of food you've ever eaten, every lungful of air you've ever breathed, every glimmer of light by which you've been able to see, every ability and talent that you've got actually comes from God. Would that be a fair statement? 1 Corinthians 4, verse 7 says this, who makes you differ from another? What have you got that you didn't receive as a gift? If you received it as a gift, why do you boast about it as though it was something you'd earned and something you deserved? Is it just possible, say, you know, that you've got a gift like music and you can use that and you can play beautifully? And you take the gift that God has given you, you never say thank you to God for giving it to you, and you take the gift to commit spiritual adultery by worshipping your own talent instead of worshipping Him. You can do the same thing in any other sphere, of course. Music just happened to be the one that popped into mind. You can do the same thing about your appearance, can't you? Same thing about sporting abilities. Same thing about intellectual capacities. And we can take the gifts that God has given, never even bother to say thank you, and use them to commit further adultery, and we're doing exactly what Gomer would be doing if she treated Hosea like that, which I expect she did. It was exactly what Israel was doing. And so God decides He's going to discipline them. What does she have to do? Verse 2. Rebuke your mother, rebuke her, for she is not my wife, and I am not her husband. Let her remove the adulterous look from her face and the unfaithfulness from between her breasts. I'm not sure that that expression, let her remove the adulterous look from her face, is the best translation for that particular line. One or two of the other versions have it a different way. Let her remove the adulterous things from in front of her face, which is probably a better idea. Two places, in front of the face and between the breasts. In front of the face, the things upon which we feed our eyes. Between the breasts, the things that we love, and we clutch them to us and we bring them as close as we can. And she loved her sin. And she is told that she has to deal with these things. Let her remove the adulterous things from before her face. Let her tear them out from between her breasts. God isn't going to do it. She has to do it. She... Suppose somebody has the habit of smoking, and assume that it is absolutely and totally a sin. See, it might be slightly debatable, it is stupid and it is dirty and it is wasteful and it is antisocial, but, you know, there are worse sins. But suppose somebody has that habit. If they live, or they have a bedroom with cigarette posters all the way around the wall, so it's the first thing they see every time they wake up, you know, and zap, there it is again. And they walk to college, and on the way to college they pass 5 stores where they sell tobacco. They're going to feast their eyes on those signs and on those stores as they go past them, and it's going to be a great temptation to them. Also, they love their tobacco. So what have they got to do? First of all, they've got to get it away from their eyes. They've got to strip down all those posters from the walls and get rid of them. And they've got to choose a way whereby they can walk to college and not pass the stores. And then they won't be feasting their eyes on them. And then they have to tear them away. I actually did talk to a young fellow one time, and he was a Christian, And he was smoking. And he lit up right in front of me. And he waited for me to be shocked. I wasn't shocked. I was just kind of sorry for him. So I didn't say anything because I knew he wanted me to say something. So I didn't say anything. He smoked for a while and he held a cigarette under my nose almost. And I just ignored it. And then he took an extra big puff and puffed it in my face. And I still ignored it. Having been in the army, it's not all that difficult. And after a little bit, he waved the cigarette at me and he said, "I'm going to give this up, you know." And I said, "Really? When?" He said, "Well, I didn't put that very well, did I? What I mean is God's going to give it up for me." I said, "Really? I think you've got a nerve. You know, as far as I know, God never took up the dirty habit. And if God never started the dirty habit, God isn't going to give it up, is he? If you're going to give it up, you give it up. If you need strength, all the strength you need is there in God, and he will supply it. But you give it up. You get them away from your eyes. You tear them out of your heart and get rid of it. God will enable you. You've got to do it." Now, I went down to talk to a group of kids in the city of Manchester, and they're a fairly wild bunch. Most of them had become Christians on a youth camp, but their background was very unhelpful. None of them from Christian homes. And I was going down to talk to them, and I was wondering, you know, how best to help them. And I made up a tape recording at home. And I went down there. When I got down there, I said to them, "You know, what you lot need here is some really good culture. You know, your problem is you don't appreciate culture and things like that. So what I've brought down here is a tape recording of some of the finest music ever made. Beautiful symphony concert played by one of the greatest orchestras in the world, one of the finest conductors. Now I want you to listen to this and just start to appreciate quality." And I, kids all like, "Oh man, what have we got here?" I turned on the tape recorder and there was a sort of interesting noise came out. We'd had great fun making it at home. We'd all got ready, the whole family, and on a given signal we switched on the tape recorder and we all started screaming at each other and calling each other all the names we'd wanted to call each other for a long time and had carefully not done. And we had a few glass bottles and hammers and things and we smashed them all up. It's great fun. And when this noise started to come out of the tape recorder, I pretended to be look very disconcerted and very embarrassed and wonder what was wrong with it and fiddle around, and all I managed to do was turn up the volume. And finally I hit the stop button. And looking most perplexed, I said, "Well, what do you think?" And one little kid said, "Oh, it sounds just like home." And I said, "Yeah, but, you know, I wanted to get a beautiful symphony out of there." And one of the other kids said, "You only get out what you put in." And he's absolutely right. And you know, your mind is just like a tape recording. Only it's a video. And you only get out what you put in. And if you put junk in there, don't be surprised if the junk comes out. And of course, there's nothing you can do about the old junk that's been put in a long time ago. You can't get that out of there. It's in there. But you don't have to feed any more in. You can control what you put in. And if you want wisdom and helpful things and things that build people up to come out, then you need to put that kind of stuff in. Just read you a couple of verses from Isaiah. "The sovereign Lord has given me an instructed tongue to know the word that sustains the weary.
He wakens me morning by morning, wakens my ear to listen like one being taught. And you see, the instructed tongue necessarily is part of the same head as the opened ear. Unless the ear is open and we're absorbing what God is saying to us, the tongue won't be an instructed tongue. It's no good just stuffing yourself with junk all the time and then expecting when the crisis comes and somebody needs your help that you're going to have the instructed tongue. No way. If you don't want junk to come out in your family relationships, and of course most of you will one day be a husband or a wife or a mother or a father, and if you don't want that home and the relationships within that home to be injured by dirt and violence and junk, then don't put it in. Because if you put it in, you can be quite sure it'll come out. So let her remove the adulterous things from in front of her face. Let her strip them from her heart, even though she loves them. They're important to her. She likes them, but she's got to get rid of them. She's got to do it. Otherwise, he says, I'm going to strip her naked and make her as bare as on the day that she was born. Imagine Hosea doing that to Gomer.